anything about you were talking about the North being the place of God and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that newsletter of David Wilkerson, he said that the North is a place of evil.
Oh, okay.
A bunch of references of them.
Yeah.
Elaborate on that.
Okay. Sure. How are you holding up as far as studying for these tests? You know, in this class here, the test tomorrow will be the last major test this semester in Apocalypse Daniel, because the next one goes up through chapter 13. So, but there will probably be one more quiz, probably like an oral quiz. And then there's one brief assignment that I'll give you next week, and it'll only take you, probably a couple hours to do. It's just harmonizing the plagues is all. It's not that hard at all. So you've got tomorrow to study for this test, and then no other really major test to study for in here other than maybe a quiz. And it won't be a real large, elaborate quiz either. So you want to keep studying for that. Okay, now there is a question that someone asked me, and a couple people have asked me this, and it's relating to the area that the Bible talks about called the North. And we're talking about how the North is the dwelling place of God. And then they were reading in David Wilkerson's newsletter, and he's talking about the evil that comes out of the North. And then he listed several references. Well, let me just say that there are times in the Bible when you have a symbol, and it can mean two different things. And you've got to look in the context to see what it's talking about. Now, when it talks about the North being the source of evil for Israel, this doesn't really relate to what we're talking about here in the book of Revelation right now, but when it talks about the North in the various prophets and evil coming out of it, it's talking about Assyria and Babylon. And if you look on a map there, Assyria and Babylon are due north of Palestine. And so when God was talking about evil coming out of the North, He's not so much talking about it coming out of His dwelling place, but He's looking at it geographically, and there's only four points on the compass to really deal with, and He's telling them that because of their sin and iniquity, evil is going to come out of the North. And that's what happened. Babylon came down, Assyria came down, and so there was evil out of the North. But there are other times in the Bible when it talks about the North, and it's talking about the dwelling place of God, and of course then it would not be talking about a place of evil. Does that answer your question, Keith? Okay, let's turn to Revelation chapter 7. Very intriguing passage here. Very interesting passage of Scripture. And I think really it shows you another facet of God's heart, another facet of God's compassion. And we're reading in chapter 7 in verse 2 about this angel ascending from the east, talking about the presence of God. And, of course, the sun rises in the east, and it's talking about the glory and the effulgence of God. And he's coming right from the presence of God, and he has the seal of the living God in his hand. We're talking about the seal being a mark of divine possession and protection. And so in this case, the seal is given to protect and to preserve a certain chosen company of people. Now, notice what he says in verse 2. He says, "And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea." And so this angel is crying out now, this angel that has this seal in his hand. He's crying out to four other angels of God. And he's telling them not to hurt the earth and the sea. Now, who are these four angels? Well, evidently they are not the same four angels holding back the four winds in verse 1. They are a different four angels. They're not the ones holding back the four winds, but rather they are the first four angels of the first four plagues. You see, there are seven distinct plagues with seven distinct angels pouring out those plagues. And he's telling the first four angels to don't pour out your plagues right now. Wait until I seal these, and then pour out your plagues. And you can read about them in chapter 8 and verses 7 through 13. Chapter 8, 7 through 13. But incidentally, the first four trumpet plagues directly affect the earth and the sea. They're poured out on the earth and they are poured out on the sea. And that's what he says right here. He says, do not pour out your plagues. And he's talking to those to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea. And it would be these first four angels. Now, we'll look at verse 3 next. You'll see what I'm saying here. Yes.
From now on, are you always going to be referring to the plague? The trumpet plagues will always be synonymous now?
Yes. Yeah, I'll talk about later on why we harmonize them that way. But anyway, chapter 7, verse 3. So this angel is crying out now. And he's saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. And so he's crying out. He's saying, hurt not the earth till. And that's a real key word there, till. In other words, the plague period is held off till certain ones are sealed by the sealing angel. And the word till is a time word. It's indicating that the delay is only temporary now. And as soon as they seal these servants of God, the plagues are going to be poured out. So we're seeing a picture of the angels of God now working together, and they're communicating together. And really, it's all symbolic. It's all symbolic. It's symbolic of the fact that God is not going to allow the plague judgments to come on the earth until he providentially seals 144,000. Well, let me read to you chapter 7, verse 4. And I heard the number of them which were sealed, and there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. Now, we're going to see these are the first fruits of national Israel. You see, we're getting very close to the second coming now. We're probably within 3.5 years, maybe even closer. But we're probably within that period of time of the second coming. And so these are the first fruits of national Israel. So this is actually a believing remnant. I believe that they are believers. A believing remnant of Israel. You see, in all ages, from the time of Abraham, God has always had a remnant amongst the Jews, amongst the nation of Israel. There's never been a time in which God allowed Israel to be extinguished from off the earth. And so God is going to preserve them. If God did not preserve them, then potentially and very possibly they could be, for the most part, extinguished from off the earth. Because the devil hates them. The Antichrist hates them. They are God's people. Now, they're not necessarily his chosen people, but the devil hates them. And so the devil would be trying to destroy them. Let me give you some scriptures here that tell you God has always had a remnant amongst Israel. In Ezekiel chapter 6 and verse 8, Ezekiel 6:8, it will tell you that. And then Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 9, it will tell you that. In Romans chapter 9 and verse 8, it will tell you that. And then in Romans chapter 11, verses 4 through 5, Romans 11, 4 through 5. So there are very frightful and very fearful judgments that are going to be poured out upon man. Now, maybe what we might want to do with questions, we might want to wait just for a few minutes because I'm going to talk about a number of points about them, and potentially I might be answering some of your very questions, but we'll open it up for questions in a few minutes here. Not that I don't want to take your questions, I certainly do. We'll wait for just a few minutes, though. Let's turn over to Revelation chapter 14. Let's look at verse 3. Here's a parallel passage now, a parallel in that it is talking about the 144,000. It is not parallel in time, though. But I want to read it to you. Chapter 14 and verse 3 through 5. It's talking about the 144,000 again. You'll notice up in verse 1 it tells you that. It says that there are 144,000 having his father's name written in their foreheads. But I want to read down in verse 3. And they sung as it were a new song before the throne. So now they are in heaven. When we are seeing them being sealed, they are still on the earth. But now in this passage they are in heaven. And they're singing this throne before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000, which were redeemed from the earth. So they are being redeemed from the earth. God is preserving them. Verse 4, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the firstfruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. Now, what I want you to note here, they are the first fruits unto God. The first fruits unto God. You see, for the nation of Israel, the harvest of souls has now begun. God is now beginning to save souls from the nation of Israel. Now, there's going to be a much greater harvest to follow. At the second coming and on into the millennium, the entire earth is going to be filled with the glory of God. And Israel is going to be saved all over the entire earth during the millennium. But the first fruits of Israel, they are saved right now. Now, what do you know about the first fruits of the harvest? That's actually given in acknowledgement that all the grain and all the increase belongs to God. And that God is going to get all the harvest and all the increase. And so these are just a token. They're just a first fruits now of national Israel. And that's indicating that God is going to have a great harvest of national Israel on into the millennium. And I think we also need to make it clear that this is a different group than the tribulation martyrs. Some people connect them. They should not be connected, though. They are an entirely different group than the tribulation martyrs who are now in heaven. The tribulation martyrs are talked about in chapter 7, verses 9 through 17, and they are not the same. There are some people that say when the Bible talks about the saints being killed in the tribulation, that's the 144,000. That's not correct. The ones that are being killed in the tribulation are actually the Laodiceans, and the 144,000 come after the tribulation martyrs. Now, there are a couple of things that indicate this to us right here in the passage. One of them is the phrase that we read here in verse 4, in chapter 7 and verse 4. It says that there were sealed 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. When God starts talking about all the tribes of the children of Israel, it shows that national Israel is in view, not the church. The church is not in view here. And we know that Laodicea is talking about the church and talking about the Gentiles, but this is talking about a different group now. There's also a couple of other indicators. Another indicator would be that the tribulation saints, down in verse 9, are a large multitude that no man can number. It tells you that in verse 9. With the tribulation saints, no one can number them. And it's like John sees them in heaven. There are so many, you cannot even begin to number them. However, with this group, it's limited. Now, it says 144,000. It might actually be more than that, as we will see. But at any rate, it is a number that you can number. 144,000, it's a special, limited group. And furthermore, the tribulation saints, they're now resurrected. And they're now raised up to heaven, and they're praising God around the throne right now. So they are praising God around God's throne. Meanwhile, the 144,000 are being sealed on the earth so that they can be spared from the great day of God's wrath. And so they're going to actually be protected from the agonies of the plague. And so the tribulation martyrs, they're not going to be in the plague period. They're in heaven before the seventh seal is even opened, see? And the 144,000, they're sealed so that they can go through the seventh seal. Do you see the difference there between the two groups? It's a real noticeable distinction, and they're not the same. Let's turn over to Romans chapter 11. Romans chapter 11, verses 1 through 2, and then Romans chapter 11, verses 25 through 27. Romans chapter 11, verses 1 through 2. Listen to what God says about the nation of Israel here. God says in chapter 11 of Romans, verse 1, I say then, hath God cast away his people? God forbid. He's talking about national Israel. And the question is, has God totally done away with them? It seemed like it. Kind of seems like it right now in a sense. But Paul answers, God forbid. For I also am an Israelite. In other words, if God did away with them, I'd be in a heap of trouble right now because I'm an Israelite. Of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin, God hath not cast away his people which he foreknew. So God, in other words, is actually maintaining a place for them in his plan. Then look down at verse 25. For I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceits. What he's doing, he's subtly reminding the Gentiles of pride. He's saying, don't you become too prideful about being grafted into the olive tree, because God is not necessarily done with Israel yet. So don't feel like you're better than Israel. He's saying that blindness in part, in verse 25, has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. Now that's a key phrase. The fullness of the Gentiles be come in. And so all Israel, he says in verse 26, shall be saved, as it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness for Jacob. For this is my covenant unto them when I shall take away their sins. Now, the point is that there is a period that the Bible talks about until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. Now, that would indicate the end of the church age. In other words, the fullness of the Gentiles, that is the church age. That's the church dispensation, or you might say the dispensation of grace. That's what you would call the time of the fullness of Gentiles. Now, the end of the church age was the sixth seal. When the sixth seal was over, the church age ended. And Laodicea now, of course, they were resurrected and caught up to be with God. And after that, the seven distinct church ages, they're now over. And God is no longer dealing with the church exclusively. That time is now over. God is beginning to deal with Israel again. And so the 144,000 then, they are the first fruits of national Israel. And so undoubtedly they have come to a living faith in Jesus Christ as their Messiah. And they are now accepting Him as their Messiah in the tribulation period. And the Antichrist is not allowed to kill them. So what we're saying is that probably they are starting to believe in the tribulation period itself, and then the Laodiceans are killed and caught up, and then, just like that, the 144,000 are sealed, and they are restored to a right standing with God. And so they become a sign then that the total gathering and the reconciliation of the entire nation of Israel is yet to come, very soon. Very soon, it's yet to come. And also, I want to point out another verse to you here. Look at verse 27. In Romans chapter 11, verse 27, "For this is my covenant unto them when I shall take away their sins." Now, again, God did not say, "This is my covenant if I shall take away their sins." He says, "When I shall take away their sins." In other words, it's just a matter of time until God is going to take away the sins of national Israel. And He's saying, "This is my covenant with them." In other words, I have a covenant with them, and I made it with Abraham, I made it with Moses and David, and every single word of that covenant is going to be fulfilled. And so I'm going to take away their sins. And there's the fullness of the Gentiles, and when that time is over, then God turns to national Israel, and God starts drawing them to Him. Now, the entire nation of Israel will not be reconciled to God until the second coming. And we read that in Ezekiel chapter 39, and verse 22, Ezekiel 39, verse 22, Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 9, through chapter 13 and verse 1, Zechariah 12, verse 9, through chapter 13 and verse 1, and then Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 3 through 4. Maybe I should read Zechariah chapter 12. This is talking about the battle of Armageddon right now. And it says here in verse 9, "And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem." And this is going to be all the nations of the world gathering against them right before the second coming. And then in verse 10, "And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplications. And they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him." I like that. "They shall look upon me whom they have pierced," and Yahweh is talking, and then it says they shall mourn for him, talking about Jesus. And it's kind of a play on words here. Yahweh is speaking, but he's also speaking about his body here, his temple that was crucified by them. But anyway, it says here, "They shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. And in that day there shall be a great mourning in Jerusalem as the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the valley of Megiddon. And the land shall mourn every family apart," and so on and so forth. And what it's talking about, all of Israel is going to begin to repent at the second coming. And in fact, all these nations surrounding them, that is going to be the thing that will cause them to repent. Especially when two-thirds of their brethren are slaughtered. Especially when all the world has just fallen apart after six devastating plagues, and now the seventh plague is just about to burst upon the earth. That's going to drive them to their knees, finally. And they're going to begin to repent before God. And so the entire nation will then be saved. And so what we were saying then is that the 144,000 are actually God's remnant, as in the days of Elijah. Remember during the time of Elijah when there were 7,000 in Israel who did not bow the knee to Baal? They did not kiss Baal? There were 7,000 that did not kiss Baal, the Bible talks about. Well, this is exactly what Israel is doing right now. There's first fruits, and they have not bowed to the Antichrist. And they are turning to God. We'll look at some possibilities how they could perhaps escape the mark of the beast here in a few minutes. But I want to read to you Revelation chapter 7, 5 through 8. You see, in all this, again, we see the mercy of God, don't we? That God would come and God would begin. You know, the Lord cannot stand to not have a witness on the earth. He's got to have a testimony. He's got to have a witness. He's got to have people somewhere that know Him. And He's never left the earth without that witness. Well, let me read chapter 7, verse 5, down through verse 8. "Of the tribe of Judah were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Reuben were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Gad, 12,000. Of the tribe of Asher were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Naphtali were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000. The tribe of Simeon, 12,000. Levi, 12,000. Issachar, 12,000. Zebulun, 12,000. Now the tribe of Joseph were sealed 12,000. And of the tribe of Benjamin, there were sealed 12,000. There's a couple interesting things here. First of all, there are a couple tribes that are actually excluded. There's a couple names that are missing in this list. Well, there's 12 tribes, all right, but there's two names that are missing. Out of 12 tribes, Dan and Ephraim are missing. Dan and Ephraim are missing. There are two other tribes that take their place. Levi and Joseph take their place. Let's talk about some of the possibilities. Remember in the Old Testament, there were 12 original tribes that came into the Promised Land. Remember that inherited the Promised Land? But which tribe did not get any land? Okay, Levi did not get any land. And then you'll notice that Ephraim and Manasseh were the two sons of Joseph. Remember that? And they actually got each of them an inheritance in the Promised Land. So that made a total of 12 tribes that actually got inheritance. And Levi did not get any. And God said, I will be your inheritance. But in this list right here, Dan and Ephraim are missing. And the question is, why? Why are they missing? I'm not sure I really have a good answer. I'll suggest a couple possibilities. Why Dan and Ephraim are missing. One possibility, and I think it's a very good possibility, is that Dan was actually the first tribe of Israel to go into idolatry. Back in the book of Judges chapter 18 and verse 2, and Judges chapter 18 and verse 30 and 31. Judges 18 verse 2 and verses 30 through 31. And so they went pell-mell into idolatry. And of course, many of the other tribes, and eventually pretty much all of Israel and Judah followed them. But someone started that. Someone got involved first with the Canaanites. And apparently it was Dan that got involved first. Furthermore, there was a king called Jeroboam. Now Jeroboam was of the tribe, I believe, of Ephraim. But anyway, Jeroboam made two calves of gold. And he located them where? Where did he put them? Do you remember? What areas did he put them in? Jeroboam, those golden calves. It was Dan and Bethel, wasn't it? The tribe of Dan up to the north, and the tribe of, and down in the city of Bethel, down in southern Israel. And so he put them in the tribe of Dan and Bethel. There was a golden calf right in the tribe of Dan, and they were worshiping that. You can look at 1 Kings chapter 12. And verses 28 through 30. 1 Kings chapter 12, 28 through 30. So it could be, as it were, a subtle retribution given to them, a subtle judgment given to them right now, that they are not going to have the honor of turning to Christ first. You see, they turned away from God first, and so perhaps God might be saying, you're going to be the last to turn to me. You were the first to turn away, and you'll also be the last to turn back to me. You know what I'm saying? Now, there's another possibility, and this might go right along with it. We're still looking at Dan. Another possibility could be this. You see, Dan was located far to the north of Israel. They were the most northern tribe in Israel. If you look on a map, they were way up in northern Galilee. And so, therefore, they were the first to be carried away into Assyrian captivity. And not only that, but apparently they were the furthest scattered. In other words, Assyria came down several times against Israel, and they took Israel away in several different periods of time. And they decimated them several different times. And so finally, in 722, when they came down and they carried all of Israel away, apparently Dan, according to many authorities, was the furthest scattered. They were the first to go into idolatry, and they were the first to be carried away, and they were also scattered the furthest. And so it's a possibility that they might not return in significant numbers until the millennium. And so now you've got many Israelites turning back to God in the 144,000, but because Dan was so scattered, and because they were the first to be carried away, perhaps they might not return to God in significant numbers until after the second coming. Incidentally, they are going to be restored again to God. We read in the millennial distribution of the land. Both Dan and Ephraim are included in the list in the book of Ezekiel, in Ezekiel chapter 48. There's a list of the tribes that come back into the land of Israel and receive an allotment in the tribe or in the nation of Israel. And Dan and Ephraim are included in that list. But again, it's interesting to note that Dan is going to be to the extreme north again. He's going to be the farthest away from any of the other tribes and the farthest away from the temple in the millennium. Now, there's another reason why some people have said that Dan is not in this list. And let me mention it to you. I think, again, the best possibility is probably the thing with idolatry. But anyway, here's another possibility. Some have suggested that the Antichrist is going to come from the tribe of Dan. And because of that, you see, God is now, in a sense, judging them, the tribe of Dan. So someone suggested that the Antichrist would come from them. There's no real solid proof of that in the Bible, but they just seem to indicate that. It does seem to indicate in the Bible that the Antichrist will be a Jew. There are some scriptures that do seem to indicate that. We'll look at that in the book of Daniel. It talks about he will not regard the God of his fathers and some other statements. He will not regard the desire of women, talking probably about the Messiah, and it seems to indicate that he might possibly be a Jew. But anyway, this theory that the Antichrist might be a Jew from the tribe of Dan is based on Genesis chapter 49 and verse 17. Genesis 49, verse 17. This is where Jacob is pronouncing a blessing, and in some instances, as it were, a curse, actually, on some of his own offspring. He's actually prophesying, in a sense, what will happen to them. And he says about Dan, listen to the words now, I'll read it to you. Dan shall be a serpent. By the way, isn't that a glowing promise to receive from your father? You're going to be a serpent. But Dan shall be a serpent, by the way, an adder in the path that biteth the horse heel so that the rider shall fall backwards. And it's the picture of Dan being a sneaky snake, and he's nipping at horses, and it's causing the horses to bolt so that the rider will fall off. It's talking about someone that's subtle, someone that's cunning, someone that's wicked. And so people look at that and they say, well, that's talking about the Antichrist. But I have one major problem with that, with the Antichrist being of the tribe of Dan, and that's this. I think it's a lot more likely that if the Antichrist is a Jew, he would actually be of the tribe of Judah. Actually be of the tribe of Judah. And here's the reason why. He undoubtedly is going to claim to be the Messiah. And this is, you know, Christ gave promise and warning after warning to the Jews, saying, watch out for false Christs and false Messiahs. And you see, the Messiah was to be the son of David. The son of David. David came from the tribe of Judah. And the Antichrist is going to actually go into the Jewish temple. And he's going to show himself that he is God. The Jews are going to apparently allow him to go into the temple, allow him to go into the Holy of Holies, and allow him to sit on, as it were, the Ark of the Covenant, which they possibly will rebuild. They don't have the old Ark of the Covenant, but he'll go into the Holy of Holies, claiming to be God, manifest in the flesh, just prior to the second coming. And the Jews know that Messiah is actually David's son. In fact, Jesus asked them that point blank. He said, who is Christ's son? Or who is David's son? I can't remember the exact terminology. But that's in Matthew chapter 22 and verse 42. Matthew 22, verse 42. So the Jews, historically, have known that their Messiah is going to come from the tribe of Judah. That's where David came from. And Messiah is going to be the second David. He's going to be of the seed of David. He's going to sit on the throne of David. And so, therefore, it wouldn't be someone from the tribe of Dan. Now, there is one other possibility here, though. Someone from Dan could claim to be David's son and therefore be of Judah. So, in other words, the Antichrist could actually be a Jew from the tribe of Dan, but could claim to be from Judah. That's a possibility, and you can't rule that out. But see, that's hither and none, isn't it? I'm just pretty much speculating right now. So that's enough for Dan. Let's move on here. You'll notice also in this list now that Manasseh is mentioned, but his brother Ephraim is not. Ephraim is not in this list. And in place of Ephraim, the name of Joseph, his father, occurs. You'll see that in verse 8 here. So Manasseh is mentioned, but Ephraim is not. Ephraim is excluded, just like Dan was. And so in place of Ephraim, his father, Joseph, occurs. And, of course, back in the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 48, it gives the account of Joseph's two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Manasseh was what? He was the firstborn. Manasseh was the firstborn son of Joseph, but Ephraim actually received the greater blessing. Ephraim was younger, but he received the greater blessing. However, in this list here, Ephraim is not included. He's actually excluded. And the possible explanation for that is this, is that Jeroboam the first was of the tribe of Ephraim. Jeroboam the first was the first king of Israel, the northern 10 tribes. And he was of the tribe of Ephraim. He was the one that led the nation of Israel into calf worship. Now, he put the calves in Dan and Bethel, but he actually built the golden calves. You can read about that in 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 20. First Kings chapter 12, 25 through 33. And incidentally, I found something out about Bethel. They put the golden calves in Dan and in Bethel. Bethel originally belonged to the tribe of Benjamin. They originally inherited that land. But for all practical intents and purposes, Ephraim possessed it. And Ephraim owned it. And so the golden calves were put in Dan and Bethel. And Bethel was the direct responsibility, from what I've read, of the tribe of Ephraim. So the tribe of Ephraim, again, allowed those golden calves to be in their land. And their very king, Jeroboam the first, came from the tribe of Ephraim. And so Ephraim also then is guilty of idolatry. You can also look at Hosea chapter 4 and verse 17. Hosea chapter 4, verse 17. And in fact, you'll notice if you carefully read the Bible that the northern 10 tribes of Israel, very often they are corporately designated as Ephraim. Have you ever noticed that, how God will often call them Ephraim and rebuke them for their idolatry? And so he labels them after that one tribe because the tribe of Ephraim became their leader. It was a leading tribe. And not only that, but Ephraim actually was the tribe that led in the division of the kingdom. When the kingdom erupted under Rehoboam, Ephraim led the rebellion for the north, the tribe of Ephraim. 1 Kings chapter 11. And verse 26. 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 26. Now, those would be my reasons that I would list for them being excluded. I might not be on. I might be way off. You know, you can find plenty of sins for almost any of the tribes of Israel in the Old Testament. And any one of those sins would actually merit exclusion from this list here. But those would be the best reasons that I can really think of. Now, I want to mention another point here. We've got just a couple more things to say, and then we'll take some questions. So don't forget your questions. And I want to say this. The Bible talks about 144,000 here, with 12,000 from each tribe. Now, that could actually mean one of two things. We could actually be looking at 12 men representing their families. In other words, I should say 12,000 men, not 12 men, but 12,000 men from each one of these tribes, representing their families. Or we could look at the sum total of 144,000. That is the men and their families. In other words, what I'm saying is that the 144,000 might be just simply limited to men. And then, of course, their family is included too, but it's not tallied in the list of the 144,000. There is a precedent for this. When Israel was numbered after coming up out of Egypt, only the men that were 20 years old and up were counted. The men and the women were not counted. The children were left out. And in Numbers chapter 1, verse 45, we read that the count is 603,550 souls. Numbers chapter 1, verse 45. But there were many, many more souls than 600,000 that came up out of Egypt. That was only the men. And so if you tabulate the women and also the children, you end up with a number probably in the neighborhood of 2 or 3 million people that actually came up out of Egypt. So God numbers 600,000, but it actually involved a great larger number. The same thing might be in view here. We might be talking about 144,000 men only that are being numbered here. But their families are also involved. We might be looking at 300,000. We might be looking at 500,000. But God is only numbering the men. And then here's another point. I believe that the order and the meaning of their names is interesting. J.A. Seitz brings this out. Each one of these names is significant, and particularly in the order in which they occur. Let me read a quote to you from Seitz. He puts this together. What he does, first of all, he gives the name of each tribe. He tells you what the meaning of that name is, and then he puts the whole picture together and forms a little paragraph putting it all together. Let me show you what I mean. He says, quote, Jude means confession or praise of God. Reuben means viewing the sun. Gad, a company. Asher, blessed. Naphtali, a wrestler or striving with. Manasseh, forgetfulness. Simeon, hearing and obeying. Levi, joining or cleaving to. Issachar, reward or what is given by way of reward. Zebulun, a home or dwelling place. Joseph, added or an addition. Benjamin, a son of the right hand, a son of old age. Now what he's going to do, he's going to take all those titles now, all those meanings, and he's going to put them together, and he's going to paint a picture of the 144,000. Listen to it. These 144,000 then are Israelites living in the period of judgment who are only then brought to be confessors and praisers of God, while the most of their kindred continue in unbelief and rebellion. Viewing the Son, as their fathers never would view him, they acknowledge him as their Messiah and judge. As Jews, they thus constitute a distinct company to themselves and are blessed. As the result of their conversion, they are also very active in practical righteousness. They strive and wrestle against their own and their nation's long forgetfulness to the truth as it is in Jesus, hearing and obeying now the voice of the Lord, cleaving to the reward in the heavenly home promised by the prophets. They are a super addition to the church. They are sons of God indeed, but sons begotten in the day of God's right hand in the period of power and judgment in the last extremity of this age. End quote. It's interesting when you look at it all together. When you put all the meanings of those words together, it actually points a picture of people that are praising and striving to be like God and are overcoming, and they become the right hand of God, as it were. Let me answer a couple more things now that you might have in your mind, and that's this. First of all, what is the meaning of this seal that is given to them? What is the meaning? What is the significance of the seal of the living God? First of all, let me say I doubt very much if it is a visible mark to the naked eye. I doubt if you could see it. You see, angels don't need to see a literal mark to protect someone. I don't think it's a literal mark myself. And furthermore, a literal mark on the forehead would not protect them anyway from trees and grass burning and water being turned to blood. And see, they're going to be preserved from those type of plagues. They're going to be preserved from natural disasters. And just a natural mark on your head would not protect you from that. It's got to be something in the spiritual realm, I believe. And we mentioned before that the seal in ancient times was a mark of ownership. It was a practice amongst the Romans for the soldiers to be marked in the hand or for slaves to be branded on the forehead. And I think this is God designating them as His, and the angels of God that bring judgment, they know and they discern now that this is a servant of God, and they shield them from judgment. So I believe it is probably a spiritual seal seen by God and seen by the angels showing that they belong to Him. I don't think it's a natural seal. I think it's probably a spiritual seal. And God can see the seal, and the angels can see that seal. And the angels are actually providentially preserving them. Now, did you know that you have a seal? Did you know that? Did you know the Bible talks about you being sealed? Let me list some scriptures here. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 22. We are sealed. 2 Corinthians 1, 22. Ephesians 1, 13. Ephesians 1, 13. Ephesians 4, 30. Ephesians 4, 30. And then John chapter 6 and verse 37. Christ was sealed. God took Messiah, and God sealed him. The Jews could not kill Jesus before Jesus went to Calvary. The devil could not do away with Jesus. He was sealed. He was preserved. There were many times when the Jews tried to kill Jesus. Remember, they took up stones to stone him, tried to throw him over the cliff. They couldn't do it. He was sealed by God. The angels were protecting him. God was protecting him, just like you're sealed. The devil can't walk up to you and just snuff you out. The devil can't bring all kinds of judgment on you. You're sealed. He can bring certain things your way, and God will allow him to do that, but he can't do whatever he wants to do. And in fact, I do not believe he has as much liberty with you as he does with the unbeliever and the ungodly. You belong to God. God's seal is on you. Turn back to the book of Ezekiel, chapter 9 and verse 4 here for a moment with me, if you would. Ezekiel chapter 9 and verse 4. God was talking here in this passage about some of the faithful Israelites that had not committed adultery. And in spite of all the abominations occurring in Israel during the time of Ezekiel, they were faithful to God, and so God protected them with a mark on their forehead. Ezekiel chapter 9 and verse 4. And the Lord said unto him, talking to an angel now, that had a writer's inkhorn by his side, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. And to the others he said in mine hearing, go ye after him through the city and smite. Let not your eye spare, neither have ye pity. And it talks about them being utterly slain. So the picture here is that the angel goes throughout the city. Those that are crying out for God, they're marked. They're spared. Those that are actually involved in the abominations are slain. Same thing happens in the book of Revelation. The 144,000, they get the mark. They're spared. The others on the earth, they are ungodly. The plagues come on them. They affect them. Here's another question. Where are the 144,000 when they are sealed? Good question. Can't necessarily answer it. But again, I've got a couple thoughts on this. Where are the 144,000 when they are sealed? You'll notice the Bible doesn't tell you, does it? Doesn't give you any indication where they are. So therefore, we cannot speak dogmatically. However, I will say this. We'll see in chapter 7 and verse 1, and then also in chapters 8 and the chapters that follow, the plagues undoubtedly are going to affect all the earth in one way or another. Now, they might be poured out upon certain portions of the earth, but the effect of them is going to be universal. In fact, the Bible tells you that. It tells you about all the mountains on the earth are affected and all the islands are affected and earthquakes are going to affect the entire earth. And so you cannot destroy like one-third of the ocean life and one-third of fresh water and all that without affecting all the world. See, so all the world is going to be affected. So therefore, it is a possibility that they could be throughout the whole earth and they're being sealed. That's a good possibility. They could be scattered throughout the whole world, just like the Jews are right now. They're scattered all throughout the world. Some of you sitting right here might be Jews. You may even know that you are a Jew. Some of you sitting here are Jews, and you may not know it. But the seed has been passed down to you if you're a male, and so therefore you are of Jewish extraction. But I've got another possibility that I think is probably a little bit better, and that's this. If you study carefully the land of Israel during the time of the plagues, apparently the land of Israel is untouched by the plagues. Now, you see, Israel is not a very big land. It's only 150 miles, I believe, north to south, and averages only about 65 miles east to west. Not very big land at all. But apparently God is going to cause this land to flourish during the plague period. Let me give you a couple of scriptures that indicate this. First of all, Joel chapter 2 and verse 3. Joel chapter 2 and verse 3. We read about Palestine, that when the armies of Armageddon come down against the Jews in Palestine, the Bible says that Palestine is as the Garden of Eden. And so the armies of Armageddon, they come down. This is right before the second coming. They come down, and all of Palestine apparently is flourishing like a tropical paradise. And so apparently for all the tribulation period and all the plague period, while the earth is lying in ruins, Palestine is flourishing. Isn't that interesting? I think that's noteworthy. I think it's something that should cause us to wonder why God is, you know, preserving that land. And then let me turn to Ezekiel chapter 38 and read this passage to you. Ezekiel chapter 38, and I want to read verse 1 and then verses 8 through 15. Ezekiel chapter 38. This is a prophecy given concerning the battle of Armageddon. Actually, God is addressing Gog and Magog, commonly known but not affectionately known today as Russia. And God is addressing them. And God is telling them, in a sense, that you are to come down against Israel. And he's giving them the permission to do this. And you can read it in verse 1 and 2. The word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech, and so forth. It's talking about Israel and her allies. They're going to come against Israel. It's talking about Russia. I'm sorry, I reversed that. It's talking about Russia and her allies coming against Israel. But what I want to read is down in verse 8. I'd like to have you follow with me here. Notice the condition of Israel now when the battle of Armageddon is beginning and when all these nations come down against her. After many days thou shalt be visited. In the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword. Isn't that what has happened now? Haven't they come back after many years? It's talking about Israel now. Have they not come back into the land again? And it says, and is gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. Now here's the picture. Here's what he's saying. He's saying the land of Israel traditionally and historically has laid in waste. If you could see Israel as of 50 years ago, what it was a few Bedouin sheepherders wandering around in that land. It was decimated. There were piles of rock and rubbish before the Jews returned to the land again. It was not a place that you would want to live. There were not that many people living there. But when the Jews came back to the land again, the land began to flourish, and they began to dwell safely, all of them, in their land, even though many countries have tried even now to do away with them. But notice it says that they shall dwell safely, all of them, talking about their condition right before Armageddon. Verse 9, thou shalt ascend, this is Israel, or Russia now, Russia, thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall also come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought. In other words, demons are going to begin to speak to their minds. They're going to start listening. The Russians and all of her allies. And verse 11, and thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. This is Israel. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations, which have gotten cattle and goods that dwell in the midst of the land. And it goes on and it elaborates on this. But notice the Bible says they are dwelling safely. They are dwelling in villages without walls around them. They have cattle. They have goods. The former area had been a waste place, but now it is flourishing. Joel says it will be like the Garden of Eden. So what I'm saying is this. It's a very good possibility that the 144,000 are actually in the land of Palestine. And that's why the land of Palestine is flourishing. God is blessing and protecting the land of Israel because the 144,000 are in the land of Israel. It tells us several times that the 144,000 are going to be preserved from the plagues. In fact, later on in chapter 9, when the fifth plague is poured out, God tells the angels of judgment, he says, pour out this plague upon everyone except on those that have the seal of God on their head. Don't pour this plague out on them. And so even though all the nation of Israel is not yet saved, the entire nation flourishes because the 144,000 are in that nation. Just like America right now. America right now, why is it flourishing? I'll tell you why. It's because there are Christians in this nation that love God. And that's the only reason. I think if there weren't any believers in this nation that loved God, this nation would collapse. With all the sin and all the iniquity and all the hypocrisy and everything else in this nation, God would bring judgment on this nation. But Christ said, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Salt preserves. And so God, therefore, spares the nation of Israel because the 144,000 are in the nation of Israel. Now, it also seems that somehow they have gotten through the tribulation period without taking the mark of the beast. Don't ask me how. I'm not sure how. But they apparently have gotten through the great tribulation period without taking that mark of the beast. The reason I say that, it says in Revelation chapter 14, and it tells us in verse 4, Revelation 14 and verse 4, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. Now, I think it is probably saying something more than what the literal might appear there. I don't think it's necessarily just telling you that they abstain from adultery and fornication, although that would be true too. But I think it's talking about the woman, and we'll see many times in the book of Revelation, world Babylon, and the harlot is called the woman. And they have not fornicated with the woman. They have not fornicated with the world church. They have not fornicated with the Antichrist government. They have not taken the mark of the beast. And I can already read your mind. You say, yes, but you are saying that everyone that doesn't take the mark of the beast is killed. True. But there might be an exemption given to the nation of Israel. Somehow, that we don't read about in the book of Revelation. There might be a couple of reasons why they might be given an exemption as well. First of all, if the Antichrist is a Jew, he might exempt them, knowing that later on he's going to go in to Israel and show himself that he is God, knowing that he wants to gain their favor, knowing that he wants to get in good with them. So he commands all the world to take the mark of the beast except Israel, except the nation of Israel. Everyone gets it except them. And so they are in the land of Israel, and they enjoy somewhat of an allowance to worship their own God. In fact, later on we'll find out they actually do build a temple. They do have a temple. In fact, that's where the Antichrist is going to go, and he's going to worship. He's going to be worshipped as God. And in fact, that's what Christ talked about as being the abomination of desolation. So therefore, they are apparently allowed to worship God, that is their Yahweh, even though they're not in the covenant of God. So apparently they are allowed to worship God to a certain extent. And so maybe the Antichrist will allow them an exemption. Now, that would be just like the Jews did in the ancient Roman Empire. The Romans came down to all the other various empires, and they commanded them when they conquered them to burn incense to Caesar. They commanded the Christians to do that. But they didn't do it with the Jews, and the reason why, they were too stubborn. They were too feisty. They were too hard to convince. The Israelites have been some of the most stubborn, indomitable people on the face of this earth. I mean, they'd just as soon have their throat slit as to do anything that would, you know, they'd rather have their throat slit than eat anything that's not kosher, or, you know, do something that would violate the Sabbath day. Or they've been an extremely stubborn people, and so maybe the Antichrist, with a combination of these things, knowing that he's going to go into their temple, knowing that he's going to show himself as God, perhaps will grant them an exemption, and therefore not demand that they take the mark of the beast. It's a good possibility. And also, there's another thought right along with that, talking about them receiving an exemption and talking about the land flourishing. This might be the very thing that causes the nations of the world to hate them so intensely. When all of a sudden they start turning back to God, and God starts blessing 144,000 of them, starts filling them, when all the rest of the world is laying in rubble, and all their skyscrapers are all now a pile of bricks, and all their water is poisoned, and then all of a sudden it comes across on the news broadcast that evening that out of all the world, this little country, 150 miles long by 60 miles wide, is the one spot on the face of the entire earth that hasn't had to receive the mark of the beast, and the Antichrist is even living with them, and on top of that is flourishing as the Garden of Eden. What do you think the world is going to do? Applaud and say, good, at least there's not judgment somewhere? No. They're going to be so upset at that, they're going to hate that so bad, that this is the last area now, they're going to come against that land with full fury. They're going to hate that. And like we read in Ezekiel chapter 38, there shall be an evil thought that will enter into the mind of the Russians. And they're going to think of that wall, that those villages that are unwalled. And they're going to think of those cities that are dwelling in safety, and they're going to go up against them. Now, all that is my conjecture, you know, a lot of this. But to my way of thinking, it does answer a number of the problems. Now, unfortunately, we didn't have time for questions. But maybe we got a half a minute. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think what we have to say is that, in a sense, you have to qualify it. Everyone receives the mark of the beast except them. That's the best I can see. I haven't heard exactly what the pastor feels on that. You know, I don't know exactly what he would say. Yes. Apparently not. We're not given. They would have been killed. I said, we'll see this later. We're going to ask the question. How did they get to the store? How did they get to the store? And then through the resurrection or whatever.